Mr. Cutlets, Mr. Cutlets, when you swing around that pork chop, I get a whiff of heaven every time you pass my doorstop. With the chicken and the brisket and the marrow and the giblets, Mr. Cutlets, spend some time with me. I know it's crazy, but it's true. It's not worth eating if it lacks the greasy. Cutlets, Mr. Cutlets, when you burst into the kitchen, you grab a fist of meatballs and a bone for wishing. With the bacon and the lamb chops and the scrapple and the ham hock, Mr. Cutlets, spend some time with me. Spend some time. Spend some time with me.
Hi, I'm Josh Ozersky, here for the Heritage Radio Network, doing the Mr. Cutlets Show. That, of course, was Don Ralph and Life in a Blender. And we're here in the back garden at Roberta's, prepared to talk about foods and food-related objects. We're here by the good grace of the Hearst Ranch in San Simeon. That is where Citizen Kane lived, and they also have various grass-fed animals that live out there. I have two friends with me. I have Stephanie Cohen, the reporter for the New York Post, here.
Hello.
And a very close member of the Team Cutlets Inner Circle.
For years.
She doesn't, you could tell by her enthusiasm how just how much that means.
I go very far back. I'm an original member.
Yeah, she knew me before I was fat. And then we also have Anthony Goncalves here, who is one of my favorite chefs in New York and has the best restaurant in Westchester, 42.
Hello.
On the top of the Ritz-Carlton Hotel Casino. And Stephanie, you know, I have various topics that have been weighing on my mind, but, you know, we were talking, sitting the other day, and he says to me, you were asking me all these, like, you told me that you want to ask me questions about the food world, and I thought, well, maybe instead of just sort of giving this valediction speech or whatever, you could
share it
just
with the world.
I figure maybe I'd just go a little more freewheeling, answer, you know, just in a more freewheeling spirit.
Well, having spent 2 hours with you and watched what you've eaten in that time, I'm curious as to what a day in the life of your stomach is like.
Well, I mean, we would need fiber optics to be, or the CRT projections to do that. But, you know, I have to eat a lot of foods. I'm called upon professionally. Like, in the mornings, I don't eat anything. Like, if I have, usually there's some kind of meat I have. Like, I have a D'Artagnan cured duck breast.
For breakfast?
Well, what am I going to, why not? I mean.
A duck breast?
I'm off the carbs.
Okay.
So I had that. I got maybe a little Benton's bacon. I have a dried Katz of salami. Right now I have a 10-pound bag of La Frida original brisket mix.
For breakfast?
Well, I don't have all of it.
What time are we talking?
That would be like you would be looking at about 8:15.
Brisket.
Brisket is one of the components in that ground hamburger mix, but.
Wow.
I'm trying to get off the carbs. Normally I would just have a bialy with American cheese, toasted bialy with American cheese.
Okay.
I'm off the carbs. But.
Okay.
And then in lunch, I usually tend not to eat lunch, but I'm occasionally called upon, as today, I had to judge the lamb contest. The American Lamb Board sponsored a lamb takedown at the Highline Ballroom, and I had to go and eat 20 different kinds of lambs. And then in the dinners, you go out and you have to bop around. I don't have the tipsters, like Eater, sending me the intelligence all the time. And I need to see what the great artists, the food artists in the city are doing. So I'll typically go to, you know, anywhere between one and three restaurants.
Three?
Well, I mean, you don't eat a whole big meal.
You don't?
No.
Tell the truth.
Stop in and have a little fouet at one place, and maybe another guy wants you to try his fried rice.
But don't all the chefs, when they cook for you, they want to impress you, so don't they send out so much food?
I know, but I told them that I can't do that anymore.
But are they listening?
No, I says to them, like, I saw Harold Dieterle from Perilla, who I think is, by the way, that's like one of the best restaurants. That's, I just saw him today. He always wears like a white V-neck t-shirt. You know what I mean?
I thought I knew him from somewhere, then I realized it was from Top Chef.
Yeah, he won Top Chef, yeah. But he's like, oh, well, you know, come in, you have a hotel. I said, listen, how fat do you want me to be?
Well, there's a movie about that, where they kill the food critic by overfeeding him. It's a really bad movie.
I didn't see that.
I know, it's terrible. And then his wife gets revenge on all the chefs. She starts killing the chefs. It was on HBO in like 1980.
Who's killing the great chefs of Europe?
Yes.
Jacqueline Bisset.
Yes.
Yeah, no. Robert Morley was the critic. I remember that.
Oh, you have seen that.
Yeah, I saw it as a child.
Yeah, me too.
Well, I eat a lot of foods, but they're not all good. And the people say, you know, they're mean, especially my critics. I have many critics.
I know.
And they always say, oh, Zersky, oh, he's that fat fuck goes around and he eats a free spaghetti. And everyone who gives him free spaghetti, he plugs, you know, who he's friends with. But what they don't know is I eat probably 10 times the amount of things that I write about, but if I don't like it, I don't. If it's bad, I don't write about it.
I think that's a totally fair attitude.
You know, like if I go to, like I did, you see that Last Meal, right?
Yeah.
Once I do it periodically, guys. Last Meal, right? Ed's Chowder House, and I said how good it was and everything. Says, oh, they must have given him free, you know, shrimps or something.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a lot of Last Meals. You just don't see me writing about them if I don't really like them.
I think it at heart you're a very kind food writer.
I think so.
I do too.
I'm an appreciator. That's how I approach it.
And if you don't like it, you don't write about it.
That's essentially the idea.
It's a whole different mindset to, you know, kill a restaurant.
Well, I don't think I have the power to kill or make a restaurant, but I you know, I don't want to.
It's just a different personality than you have.
Well, I guess there's something to that. And then the other thing, too, you have to realize is that I have to be aware that everything that I eat is about 15% better than it really is.
Right.
Like, that's true of all food writers. It's true of all food critics, but it's true of all food writers across the board. Like, I'm always the soigné table, unless somebody up the food chain, you know, is there, like Bruni or, you know, whoever, you know, Ruth, whatever. Like, no knuckleheads are going to be serving me, you know what I mean? Like, you're going to have, like, the same things. Like, it can't be better ingredients than they actually have.
Yeah, but you have to listen to all the long explanations from the waiters, and you have to get so much attention. I find that to be a big drawback to going out to eat with you.
What? The food's delicious. The attention is the best part.
There's much attention.
But that's good. Who doesn't want attention?
Hot waitresses, I guess.
Yeah. No, even if it was like a fat, ugly, bald man. I mean, just the fact that he's like paying attention.
It's impossible to have a conversation with you, though.
Well, it's impossible to do that anyway because I'm so narcissistic. You know that.
That's true. So, do you think the way that food is
fetishized.
Is that it? In New York right now is a little bit over the, like the fried chicken and the burgers and all these like articles and.
No. I mean, I'm the wrong.
I think it's ridiculous.
Well, I'm the wrong one to ask because
you're part of it.
It's like asking Colonel Sanders if he thinks people eat too much chicken.
But I mean, why is it happening now? What happened? What changed?
Well, what happened was that there is a prevalence of a kind of a critical mass of people that have communications media available to them. You know, Liebling once said that the freedom of the press belongs to everybody that owns one.
Right.
And at that
time,
it's the
blogs.
It was ironic because only three people own them or whatever. But like, yeah, there, you know, you can make there's a certain sensibility, a certain kind of person that you call foodies, gastronomes, what have you, that has a deep and profound excitement about good food.
Mm-hmm.
And that excitement, which was always there if you sat around with Jews on the Upper West Side in 1974, like it's no different culturally.
Right.
But now they have the means to make it manifest and turn on other people to it. And then the other people find out about other things and it ratchets it, you know, exponentially upwards.
And the whole, the Food Network, obviously.
Yeah.
But well,
I mean, the Food Network is more for, I think, the little old lady from Dubuque or something. You know what I mean?
Do you think, you know what I find surprising whenever I'm out with you and you get recognized, which happens quite often, it's always dudes.
If it doesn't, I'll tell them.
Why? Well, it's never
like, hello, my name is.
You associate cooking with you know, women traditionally, but it's guys that watch that read your blog. It's guys that recognize you. It's guys that are all the food writers are all guys.
They're not all guys. There's a lot of women food writers. The chefs are all men.
The chefs are all. Well, that's always
been
the case.
But the food writers, the most powerful ones are invariably men, at least right now. Like the critic of the Times is a man. The critic of New York Magazine is a man. Pete Wells is a man. Ruth is very powerful.
Do you have any thoughts about
Gabriella Gershenson, who's the food editor of Time Out.
Do you have any thoughts about why on a professional level it's more? I mean, not to get into a whole gender dialogue, but why it's more men than women
in the media aspect
and,
of it?
That are professional cooks, whereas cooking is so often traditionally thought of as a female.
Well, since Anthony's here and he's a man, let's bring him in the subsequent segment to this, and we'll ask him about it because he's all man.
Way back up in the woods, I was so ragged that folks used to call me Patches. Papa used to tease me about it, cause deep down inside he was hurt cause he'd done all he could. My papa was a great old man. I can see him with a shovel in his hand. See, education he never had. He did wonders when the times got bad. The little money from the crops he raised barely paid the bills we made. Oh, life had kicked him down to the ground. When he tried to get up, life would kick him back down. One day, Papa called me to his dying bed, put his hands on my shoulder, then in tears he said, Patches, I'm depending on you.
And you're back with the Mr. Cutlet Show. Oh, that song gets me every time. Poor Patches. I am here in Roberta's wonderful restaurant, one of my favorite restaurants, by the grace of Hearst Ranch and its grass-fed cattle. We're here on the Heritage Radio Network with New York Post reporter Stephanie Cohen and 42 chef Anthony Goncalves. And Steffi was just asking me why there are so many more men in chef. I could maybe begin to answer about writers, but as far as why men are chefs more than women...
That's a tough one, you know. My staff, there's only two young ladies that work with us, but the other 18 are men.
Hmm.
And it's long hours, and you know, I don't know. I really don't know. The girls that I have working for me, though, are great, and they bring a whole other dynamic to the kitchen.
But maybe I mean, they say, like, part of it is that, the atmosphere is so... I mean, not just physically, but also, I mean, it's demanding because the guys are like, they're all just drunks and perverts and
That's what Bourdain said.
Well, it's true.
But when you go into some of those kitchens and they're all polite and kind, you get disappointed. You want them to be more.
That's what you say. That's what you say. But yeah, they're a bunch of pirates. You know, it's a really tough business. A lot of pressure, and. I think from my point, it's, you know, any dish that goes out is me. So I'm very serious about that. What I then get from my guys is, I bring them the vision and I explain to them about the passion. Most definitely very passionate people seem to stay with me. I think that every night we get challenged and it gets out of control and people love that.
I mean,
they love to watch
it's
that
like battle.
It's a battle.
But I mean, if you really want to see the true like gender bias or what not, maybe not gender bias, maybe it's just reified or whatever. But like the girls, not only do they not work, you know, on the line that much. And certainly when they do rarely become chefs, but what usually happens is say, you go make cupcakes or whatever, you know, mm-hmm. like there you could make a frostings, you know, or like little sorbets and all the, you know, and it's interesting too, because if you look at like the pastry chefs, like there's even, you see a very clear difference in the way that they cook between the girls and the boys. The boys all make the disgusting savory desserts with like the weird films and flans and stabilizers. And then the girls make the actual sweet, you know, homey type, you know, dessert.
That's not.
Well, it is true. Look at the leading dessert chefs in New York. Nancy Olson, Karen Damasco, Gina De Palma, Heather Bertinetti.
And they all cook sweet
they
cupcakes?
All, yeah, they all like to make sweet, delicious things with normal flavors and whatever. None of them are going to give you, like, foie gras and peanut butter Napoleons or, like, durian flan.
Yeah, you don't see that.
That's the male, like the, you know.
But solid desserts you see from them. Delicious desserts from them.
Desserts you actually want to eat.
Yeah. Right. I think so. You know, so people could get very carried away easily. You know, but again, it's your expression, and you know, either people get it or they don't.
It's true, and you know, like I'll give you an example of a woman chef who I had totally doesn't cook. Like, I don't know if there's such a thing as girly food or not. If there is, it's not usually cooked by girls. It's cooked by molecular gastronomists. But Jean Adamson at the Vinegar Hill House is one of my favorite restaurants now.
You told me about.
I love that place, and she like. If I had a restaurant, that's exactly what it would be. Like, it would have a... I mean, physically, it looks like only a woman could have a restaurant this nice. But, like, a pork chop, the chicken with the, you know, the sherry vinegar, clear schmaltz butter sauce, pan drippings, the, you know, the little tart flambé. You know, it's like it's really elemental cooking that I, you know, really feel in my kishkas.
I always thought kishkas was a meal. Like well, kasha.
Technically a kishka.
Derma
kishka. It's an intestine. Well, it's like an intestine that's stuffed with carrots and cornmeal and chicken fat all mixed up, or beef tallow all mixed up together.
So when's the bubble going to burst on the celebrity chef?
Well, if it was going to burst, it would have burst already.
So it's not going to burst.
And Emeril has come
away.
And gone.
Emeril's
gone. Super Mario has already, like, you know... come and gone as having his own show.
So being a chef now is a path to stardom and mega millionaire.
Well, I mean, it's
if you want that.
No, but it's a path to doing that. Like being a cocktail waitress is a path to being a movie star. Like, you know what I mean? Or like being a whore or whatever.
Yeah, but being a cook.
That's a bad example.
Yeah.
But, I mean, there's a lot of people. If you become a cook with the idea that you're going to have a show on the Food Network, you're not a real
right.
cook. You're not a real chef. Like,
but there are people that obviously... young guys and girls that are going to culinary school to be the next Food Network star. You know,
do you get them in there? Do you get young cooks out of school?
They don't last with me.
What happened?
Yeah, what happened?
The minute I start hearing a lot of that,
What did they say?
You know, it's like we already know. We put them on guard and we get them out of there.
Well, what do they say?
You know,
how do they indicate to you that they're?
You could tell. You know, I got hardcore. I'm hardcore food, and I live it. And you know, I don't. Necessary. I applaud everyone on TV. I think that's fantastic. I don't know. You said Food Network before. I think that it's a good thing because it's educating where I come from in Westchester County. It's educating a lot of the people that live up in the suburbs about food,
mm-hmm.
and so that in Top Chef, and so that when they come into my restaurant, they're a little more familiar with what they're seeing and what they're tasting. Whereas before, I was getting pushbacks on like they couldn't even read my menu, which is. It's disturbing and it's disappointing, but it doesn't stop me. But when I get, you know, my next cook or, you know, whatever in the restaurant, and they're all into dropping names and talking Food Network business and talking about Top Chef the night before, do that at your lunch break. And, you know, let's break down what we have to do and get prepped and get meased up for the evening. Because for me... I'm in the hospitality business, and anyone that walks in my restaurant is got to leave very satisfied. And, you know, it's all about the experience. And so I don't have time to, you know, think about anything else. It's great that it's out there, and I'm very happy about that, but that's not me, and that's not what I want around me. You know, it's just...
I find that to be a common... refrain of a lot of chefs. I mean, especially like the kind of like really, you know, the guys that are, you know, they're really, I mean, you know, sweat the technique. The guys that are like the really like have been in it, have paid their dues, have been cooks for many years, everything. Like Marco Canora, I remember him telling me like how much he just, you know, was just so appalled by these young guys coming out on, you know. And then the other thing too is that like. These guys went to cooking school and paid like whatever it is, $20,000 or something to go to cooking school. So like the idea of being, you know, of sitting there and, you know, cutting up vegetables or battering squids or whatever for, you know, years and everything, that doesn't appeal to them. They want to go right, you know, into the spotlight. And they do too. A lot of chefs now, well, I think we'll talk about this after the break, but there's a lot of guys are opening restaurants. They can open, you know, little places out in these outer boroughs, as we call them, and really before they're, you know, before they've really mastered their craft. All right, so we're going to take a little break. We will see you back here in a minute or so. And this is the Mr. Cutlet Show. Hi, this is Josh Ozersky, the City Search National Restaurants Editor, and also known as Mr. Cutlets. We're here at Roberta's at the Heritage Radio Network, sponsored by the Hearst Ranch, and I'm here with Stephanie Cohen from the New York Post, and Anthony Goncalves from 42, the best restaurant in Westchester. And we were talking about why young cooks are bad sometimes because they're thinking too much about being big shots and not enough about standing in front of their spaghetti pot or whatever. Is that right, Anthony?
I think so. You know, to each his own. And hard knocks or no hard knocks, I think dedication and being serious about what you do, but it's a craft. And if you don't put enough attention to it, you're going to burn quick.
I mean, that's such a difference, too. Like, that's the thing about, like Stephanie was asking me before about, like, what's it like for me to go out and everything, you know? Like when I go out, I always get the soignée plate. Like, everything's cut right. The meat was always, like, cooked just right to order. You know what I mean? Like, everything's plated right. It's
everyone's on their game.
Everyone's on their game. Like, that's the one point when they say, like, it's not, you know, when you're taking into account the opinions of food writers, it's not whether somebody is getting, like, is friends with somebody or they're nice to them or whatever. Everyone knows who everybody is and they all get good treatment. You know, what about that guy? And this is where the bloggers come in. The guy who's really is an anonymous blogger, you know, that he's sitting on table 70, you know, and he comes in for, like, his 9:30 reservation. Is he going to get everything perfectly, you know, brunoise and everything? You know?
Listen, we have to sweat everything, you know. Google the reservation list. Do whatever we have to do to know who's coming in the restaurant. If you don't do that, it's a foolish play.
You Google every name.
Every single name.
That I find
so funny.
Is that true?
Come on, we got to.
Now, what if
you know, we don't know who's who.
So who turns up?
Well, you never know who's connected to who.
But can you really find out? I mean, you have, like, a researcher on your
Well, let's say, Anthony, that you see, for example, that Alan Richman is coming in or a Tanya Wenman Steele.
So I'm going to know that they're there.
Well, what happens? Do they put a PPX in the computer or how does it work?
Walk us through it immediately.
Everyone in the restaurant is warned of it, from the GM to myself to the sommelier, and now the staff is briefed on it. We obviously get to put our better staff
in all
on that
the
table.
Spheres. The music of the spheres begin to revolve
but
around that table.
I'm not creating a new dish because that guy's coming in.
Right.
You know, Alan is going to eat what he wants to eat. I'm not going to push on him either. I feel that when you do that, why do that? And everyone, I'm going to cook for everyone in the restaurant just the way I would any other night. But if Alan doesn't pick the octopus,
right,
he's going to get it.
He's going
to
get it.
Whether he likes it or not.
See, and that's what happens to me, too.
I would be curious as a reporter whose job it is to go and figure
and
out.
And Google that?
Yeah, to find, because
a receptionist every
she just,
day.
So if it comes
that's
up.
That's her job, 3:30. She goes in, because we get late reservations as well, so we got to know about those, too.
That's
after
really
5,
cool.
I'm sort of done, though. Then it's just taking the rezo and you're going with it.
But I'll tell you, you know, the thing is I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you, but with food like yours that's so elaborate, you know, and beautiful, like, it really is. Like, it's hard to really improve it from one dish to another.
Thank
but, like,
you.
a certain kind of restaurant that I find especially appealing that is like very elemental. We were talking about Vinegar Hill House. Like, I got that pork chop at Vinegar Hill House, and it was like so perfectly, like spot on the, you know, on the money.
You told me about it.
Yeah, but like if I hadn't got it, if it was cooked a little too much, then it's just a pork chop on a plate.
Right.
Well, then what am I going to do with that? You know what I mean? Like, I'm not going to go, oh, I went to this place and they gave me a, you know, a well-done pork chop on a plate. Something like that, the really elemental type foods, which now I think is very much sort of like in the air, especially with these young line cooks. Like, they don't know how to do the stuff that you're doing. So they are just trying to make, you know, executed. Right?
Well, they can learn if they pay attention and work hard.
For you?
Yeah. For most, you know, I would say most people that are passionate. I mean, that's why you go to work for a chef, you know? You get there and you say, teach me, whip me.
Well, who were some of the... Can you name a couple of the chefs that were influential for you?
You know, Heinz Beck in Italy showed me something that I never saw before. And that was a big inspiration for me. He's at the Cavallari Hilton in Rome. Before 42, we did a little... We moved around. We went to Italy. We went to Spain. We went to Chicago. Rick Tramonto at True 6 years ago, you know, cooked me a meal that changed the way I think about food. I'm a playful person and he's playful, so we got along really well. But, you know, just what he did with food sort of changed the way that I cook now, you know, because I'm not scared to do anything. And I love playing with food and I love bringing it back, you know. So things that I grew up with are things that you're going to eat, except they're going to be in my interpretation, my delivery, and my flavor profile.
Yeah, well, you have a very unique voice, definitely as a cook. Steffi, I mean, I forget sometimes what it's like, though, as a civilian. Like, I go and eat this stuff so much.
Mm-hmm.
What's it like? I mean, you come with me sometimes or whatever, mm-hmm. but, like, when you go and you see these new unusual dishes, I mean, what's it like for you when you go to a restaurant? Do you want to have this like amazing thing? Do you want to just have a pork chop? I mean, when you read my stuff, are you let down when you go, or is it not as good? What is the deal?
Well, I live in the East Village, and my obsession is that I would say it's street food from other countries but it's actually made by authentic people from, you know, authentic, you know, whatever it is, hummus from Israelis, not just Israelis, though. I can get 7 times, you know, types of hummus from all over the Middle East in like a 2-block radius of my apartment. Mm-hmm. Dumplings from, you know, this region of China or that. Like, that's what interests me right now, is how cheap and wonderful and well made that food is.
Yeah.
And also I'm on a budget, but well, that
you're gonna
I think
see,
is...
See, you're going to see less of that too.
Why?
Well, because the East Village is pricing those guys out.
That's the best part of the East Village.
Well, I know that's why so many people want to live there, and that's what happens.
I mean, that's what I eat for dinner on a normal night. I'm not going and having tripe with, you know.
Well, tripe is another of those ethnic peasant things that you could be eating. Personally, I can live without all them bean pastes. I never had a hummus that I liked better than any other hummus. Barbunius is very good, but.
I mean, I think that like under $10, perfectly made. Sort of, you know, elemental dish to a country that's like the street food
like a perfect
country.
Taco,
perfect taco, perfect. An empanada, yeah. Or a, you know, or a dumpling, or I mean, they're all over. That's what the East Village is, does best for me. I like going out to, you know,
well, that's something
exciting meals, yeah. But I can't eat that every night, man.
I know it's
tough.
It's tough, you know, and I think sometimes too that our sensibility may get a little jaded sometimes. I mean, that we, the writers and chefs, too. I mean, you know, I mean, you're just operating on this high level. You have access to these incredible ingredients, you know. I mean, like, I'm like, oh, it's Thursday. Must be Scottish crayfish, you know. I mean, it's in a way, it does screw your perception so much, somewhat.
Screw?
I mean, it screws it up.
Skew,
yes. Anyway, I'm glad that we had this little symposium here tonight.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
I'm Josh Ozersky. We're here at Roberta's, and this is the Mr. Cutlet Show.
Mr. Cutlets, when you swing around that pork chop, I get a whiff of heaven every time you pass my doorstop with the chicken and the brisket and the mashed